First part, he clearly hadn't. He'd stated it as a fact because Dazel Charnage was so very obviously a man one would ask about pawn shops. Dazel should probably take offense, stand on his dignity, and consign Mr. Cassian to the devil. Any self-respecting gentleman would. But Dazel was rather short on self-respect and indeed gentlemanliness these days. And was there really much point in taking offense at what was, after all, the truth? Cassian looked exquisitely awkward, but he pressed on. I apologize for my clumsiness, but to be honest, I find myself out of my depth. I only have a month, you see, and I've wasted 2 days of it already. What happens after the month is up? I have to go home. Dazel considered him. He looked to be in his mid-twenties. Mid-brown hair, middling sort of build, on the shorter end of mid-sized. Nothing noteworthy about him. If he was asking about a man who looked like everybody else, people might inquire whether he'd tried a mirror. Except for the mouth. He had a nice mouth, well-shaped in an unobtrusive way, with a gentle, almost wistful upward turn to it, as though it was his habit both to smile and to hope. Dazel liked people who smiled and hoped, because he did so himself. Sometimes those were the only things he could do. But returning to the initial point of the examination, Cassian looked mid-twenties, and he felt well off. So why would he have to go home? A wife waiting? Responsibilities? And you want a partner in your search? Dazel asked. Yes, someone who knows his way around. A man of the world, which I freely admit I am not. And you think I am? You have that reputation. Oh, I know my reputation, Dazel said. I might even deserve some of it. I understand you live by your wits, Cassian said. That's precisely what I need, because my own wits, I shan't say they're blunt, but they need to be sharpened by experience that I don't have time to acquire. Naturally, it would be entirely at my expense, and his eyes flickered over Dazel. If it would not offend you, I'd be most glad to recompense you for your time. Of course it was offensive to suggest hiring a gentleman. Any man of good birth and self-respect would dismiss him at once. What recompense have you in mind? Cassian looked blank. £50. Dazel did not spit out his mouthful of ale, though it was a close thing. £50. That would keep him afloat for a full year if he handled it wisely. He wouldn't, of course, it would be gone in a month, but the concept was irresistible. A month assisting you, he clarified. Yes, if you aren't busy, but you said you had an engagement. Dazel waved that away. No matter, it isn't important. He mostly lived on the charity of people who owned large houses and liked to fill them with company. To make that work, one had to avoid overstaying one's welcome. And these days he had a limited number of people willing to host him. A month fending for himself at Cassian's expense. Then maybe 2 months living off his £50 if he was sensible. Yes. He'd make himself that bit scarcer now, and with luck people would be pleased to see him come the winter. This could keep the wolf from the door for a while. So, he said, what is this item you're seeking? It's a ring. Of course it was. A full-length portrait would have been too easy. I'm not a Bay Street runner either. What if we don't find it? I realize that's quite possible, likely even. But I need to try it and know I've done my best. Cassian said, and his expressive mouth twitched, just for a second, into a look of deep distress. Very understandable, but I meant if we don't find it. He let that hang. Cassian looked blank. Dazel sighed internally. People with money never thought about these things. He hadn't when he'd had money. I still get paid. Oh, yes, of course, your time and effort will still have been spent. What a very pleasant man. And you want what? A companion, assistant, generator of ideas about what to do next? All of that, especially the last. And you said £50. Daisel checked in case he'd misheard and it was 15. Well, I am happy to do my best for what it's worth, which was apparently 50 quid. He'd never been so highly valued in his life.
You will?
Cassian's eyes lit. Thank you very much.
The pleasure is all mine.
I think our first step should be to command a dinner, awaiting which you shall tell me everything, and then we'll make a plan.
Of course, yes.
Cassian looked remarkably pleased with himself, as if he'd achieved something greater than paying an aimless, not quite gentleman for help. Odd fish, Daisel thought.
Perhaps we could order a meal and I must ensure I have a bed. I slept dreadfully last night. So noisy.
After years in coaching inns, Daisel could sleep through cries of fire, and indeed had. Mr. Cassian was clearly more delicate in his tastes. Intolerable, he agreed.
Shall I?
He didn't particularly want to be a dragoman arranging Mr. Cassian's travels and smoothing his way, but it seemed only right to offer. Cassian gave an automatic-looking nod, then said,
No, that is, I should prefer to do it.
Of course, Daisel said, since he didn't care, and rang the bell.
Let's see what the rogue in charge here has to offer.
The answer to that was mixed. The inn was very busy, the innkeeper Sturridge said dismissively. The gentleman would have to wait, and something to eat would be along in due course. As for a room, he dared say they could accommodate Mr. Cassian on the top floor. Daisel listened to Cassian give politely ineffectual objections to the first, thus guaranteeing he'd eventually be served whatever was deemed unworthy of more determined guests, and reluctantly accede to the second, at which point he realized that Greenhorn wildly overstated the man's experience of staging inns.
Enough of that, you wretched villain, he informed Sturridge. I'm meeting with him and we'll have beef collops, sweetbreads and green peas, plus a bottle of whatever drinkable wine you may have, and not watered if you value your life.
If Cassian was paying, and he'd need to be because Daisel couldn't, then Daisel would be taking full advantage.
And you'll put him somewhere decent, fool, not the attics or over the stables. Can you not recognize a gentleman when you see one?
Might see one here, yes, retorted Sturridge, turning his gaze on Daisel in a meaningful fashion. And who's paying for this, I'd like to know? Paying with more than cut paper, I mean.
I am,
Cassian said, sounding rather faint. Sturridge gave a grudging nod.
Well, as for a room, if you'll share, there's the front room, best I can do.
Then I suppose it will suffice, Daisel said. If the sheets are damp, I shall personally wrap your head in them till you resemble the turnip you are.
Sweetbreads and collops,
Sturridge snarled, making it sound like a particularly filthy oath, and departed. Daisel caught Cassian's astonished expression.
Old friend, he explained. Acquaintance, anyway. Well, he's a shocking fellow, but his good lady is an excellent cook. Now, tell me about this thief of yours.
Cassian actually blushed, as if Daisel had said something embarrassing.
Well.
He launched into a tale of a chance meeting, an invitation to dine and gamble, excessive drink. It was all very plausible, except that he told it with a certain amount of care, and the rather charming red stain over his cheekbones persisted. Probably whores had been involved, and the inexperienced Mr. Cassian didn't want to admit it, as if Daisel gave a curse. He wrung out a description of the thief John Martin. Medium height, dark hair, hazel eyes, mulberry coat. It wasn't much to go on, although Daisel liked the sound of mulberry. Perhaps he should spend some of his £50 on a new coat. Once he lost the remnants of a gentlemanly appearance, he'd be in deep trouble. They discussed strategies for finding the thief's destination over dinner. Daisel thought they might as well throw darts at a map of England, but the discussion seemed to make Cassian happy and they had a very pleasant meal, since Mrs. Sturridge was indeed a fine cook and had liked her profile. Wider conversation was a little stilted at first, since Cassian wasn't very forthcoming. He lived somewhere in the country to the west of Gloucester, but not actually Wales, and that was about as much as he wanted to say of himself. Daisel didn't press. He wouldn't have wanted to rehearse his own circumstances and recent history, and probably Cassian was aware of that since he didn't ask. So instead they talked about the news, politics, and anything that didn't address awkward questions such as, who are you? What's your life like? They were to share a room that night. That didn't trouble Daisel, who frequently found himself sharing sleeping quarters or even beds with strangers. A room with two people and two beds, paid for by somebody else, and shared with someone who didn't look louse-ridden and wouldn't rifle through his pockets in the night, was luxury. Cassian might even be too refined to snore. The room was quite adequate, considering. He checked under the bed all the same.
What are you doing?
Cassian asked. I once found a fellow lurking under the bed, no idea if he wanted a free night's sleep or to cut my throat and rob me, but it stays with you.
I should think so.
Cassian looked alarmed.
Is that usual? Ought one always check? It rather depends on the sort of inn you frequent.
Daisel had many stories of inns he'd frequented, ranging from the absurd to alarming, and he deployed a couple of them now. He wanted to make friends since he liked to be friends, and the next month would be more pleasant that way. But he also had an urge to make Cassian laugh again, because he had a delightful laugh. It was a sort of surprised gurgle, as though he was startled and even a touch embarrassed by his own amusement. And Daisel thought it was charming. So was the smile that lingered after his laugh, keeping those expressive lips in a curve that took a moment or so to fade. One wouldn't call him handsome exactly, but it was an endearing smile. Not to mention that he was rather amusing too, offering an account of hostelries in France and Switzerland, which had Daisel in stitches, even as he filed away that Cassian had made a grand tour. They chatted very pleasantly as they both got ready for the night. Cassian did so with an odd combination of carefulness and carelessness, including dropping a perfectly good shirt on the floor, as if he expected someone to pick it up for him, and to have a clean one waiting tomorrow. Daisel also couldn't help noticing that Cassian's bare torso in the candlelight was perhaps a little more impressive than expected. He was slender, but he had a rider's or a fencer's body with gentle lines of muscles showing as he moved. Trim, Daisel thought appreciatively, and stopped looking on that thought. He had £50 to earn. Now was not the time to do something rash. The next morning they got down to business bright and early over a slapping breakfast. Daisel felt he could get used to someone else paying. The knowledge he wouldn't have to argue about the bill added savour to his sausages. If we go back to Gloucester and try the pawn shops, we may find the ring, he said. But we have no guarantee it was pawned rather than fenced, or indeed if Martin has disposed of it at all. It will take a couple of days to go through them all, and if that fails, we will doubtless find it more difficult to pick up the fellow's trail. I suppose we could split up, he added with a little reluctance. He'd woken with pleasant anticipation of companionship for the day. Cassian looked torn. I suppose perhaps we could, but then how would you find me again if you did locate the ring? You could give me your address.
Oh, yes. He didn't leap on the idea, which was fair. He naturally wouldn't want Daisel Charnage turning up at his home, claiming acquaintance and a bed for a week.
It's very hard to know what to do for the best. As you said, I can't simply ask at every coaching inn for an ordinary man in a mulberry-coloured coat.
No, although... Daisel stopped. Just a moment, is that what you've been asking?
Yes, of course.
In those words?
Yes.
Cassian looked a little alarmed.
What colour is mulberry?
Darkish purple with a touch of pink.
Daisel snapped his fingers at Sturridge, who was walking by.
Rogue, what colour are mulberries?
Sturridge gave him a look.
Black, what do you think?
Anything else?
Red, if they ain't ripe, he pondered. Green, if they really ain't ripe.
What sort of red?
What do you mean, sort of red?
Red!
Sturridge rolled his eyes and walked off. Daisel turned back to Cassian, who said,
I feel exceedingly foolish.
Some people will have understood you. Sturridge is more than usually uninterested in the world around him. Nevertheless, I have wasted 2 days by asking the wrong question. I should have realized it was the wrong question. I didn't think. And now I have lost time and doubtless the trail by making that assumption. Nobody ever said, "What do you mean by Mulberry?" No, they'd just taken his money, and Dazel didn't blame them. Ask a silly question, get a useless answer. Still, he looked genuinely upset, and Dazel felt a stab of sympathy.
Do you know what? I think we should start again. Let's go back to Gloucester, to the Bird in Hand. I might be able to get more out of the landlord than you did, since you were in an awkward position at the time.
Cassian's shoulders sagged. You probably could. I asked him about Martin, where he'd gone, but he was shouting about his bill and I was only wearing a blanket. And I could hardly assert myself, or I should have, I know that, but to start making a fuss in such humiliating circumstances.
Hey, Dazel said. You had a cursed nasty time of it. You were robbed by someone you considered a friend, or at least a pleasant acquaintance. That's a distressing thing to happen even without the embarrassment of being caught in a state of nature. You needn't blame yourself for not being at your best.
Cassian just looked at him for a few seconds. Dazel said, No? No. I mean, do you realize you haven't said a word of blame or ridicule to me about the whole affair? Dazel blinked. Why would I? Everyone else has.
If Dazel went around telling people when they'd been fools, it would be very like Cassian searching for ordinary men. They should both look in the mirror first.
I dare say everyone else must have led a very sensible, secure, consistently well-judged, and exceedingly fortunate sort of life where they have never made a mistake, he said. I envy you your acquaintance.
That, or they're a pack of hypocrites.
They are not, Cassian said strongly with a flash of colour into his cheeks, which was overtaken by a lurking grin. Perhaps a touch inclined to pass remarks.
But it was foolish of me, so they have every right.
Dazel said. Let's find the Gloucester coach. They went to the yard. Cassian strode ahead with a determined stance, as if signalling his intention to take the lead. Dazel followed happily along. Cassian found out about the Gloucester coaches without difficulty, paused, then asked the ostler,
I wonder if you can help me. I'm looking for a man who would have come through here perhaps 3 days ago or more recently. A little taller than me, dark brown hair.
He gave the rest of the nondescript description.
And he may have been wearing a coat in a dark purple-pink colour, like an overripe raspberry on the turn.
Oh, him, the ostler said. 2 days ago, that was.
You saw him?
Saw him, the man snorted. You might say. Passed me a Dutch shilling, he did. Me done like a right Johnny Raw.
I will be very pleased to replace it for you with another for your trouble, if you can tell me where he went,
Cassian assured him. The ostler put out his hand and made a point of biting the coins he was given.
He took a seat at Worcester.
Cassian turned to Dazel with a grin of triumph.
Then we shall need 2 seats on the Worcester coach.
Dazel couldn't help a moment of optimism as he smiled back. Perhaps they could track down this Martin fellow. Perhaps his aid might make the difference. It would be very pleasant to have a success chalked up to his name. It was harder to maintain that optimistic frame of mind when they joined the stage. Stagecoaches were punitive things at best, and this, a 6-seater, was particularly bad. The interior was a little over 3 feet wide, so to wedge 3 adults onto each seat was difficult even when they were of a slender build. They were relatively fortunate to grab a center and corner seat, less to have their backs to the direction of travel, significantly less so to be sharing the coach with several well-built and well-fed men. Dazel pushed Cassian into the corner and wedged himself next to him, taking the middle seat with the £50 firmly in mind. He was quickly glad he'd done it.
Cassian's knuckles were white on the strap as the coach bounded its bone-jolting way along the road. And Dazel, pressed up tight against his slim frame, but not in an enjoyable way, could feel his tension. "Don't travel much?" he asked quietly. He hardly needed to shout despite the rattling of the coach. Packed as they were, a turn of his head brought his mouth all too close to Cassian's ear. "Not on the public coach." Cassian spoke with a grimness that made Dazel hope he wasn't going to be sick. "This conveyance appears to be entirely unsprung, and why are the seats not padded?"
"You don't travel much,"
Dazel agreed.
"Could be worse, friend," one of the men opposite said, jovially, and went on to make that a self-fulfilling prophecy by launching into a rambling anecdote. Dazel inferred from the expressions of the other passengers that he was a stagecoach bore, and would probably tell his stories from the start every time a new passenger joined them. He adopted the blank expression of a man who couldn't hear a thing in the faint hope it would discourage the talker, which was quashed by Cassian's polite,
"Very good, sir. Excellent."
At the long-awaited end of the story.
"Ah, if you think that's funny," the boar exclaimed.
One of the men opposite shut his eyes in despair. Dazel trod on Cassian's foot for all the good it would do. At least it relieved his feelings. It was two stages to the blue board at Worcester, through which the dull man talked without pause, mercy, or as far as Dazel could see, breathing. Dazel clambered out of the coach in the usual exhausted, battered, rumpled state, but with a powerful sense of relief at escaping. He couldn't help noticing Cassian didn't seem to feel even that. He looked wretched.
"Are you all right?" Dazel asked.
"No, that was dreadful."
"You aren't mistaken, Lord, what a bore.
I don't mean him. Well, I do, but the stage. That appalling conveyance, the smell. The discomfort was beyond anything.
I'd rather walk. How can anyone bear it?"
He sounded strangled.
"What the blazes, for a month? It's intolerable."
"If you can't stand it, why not hire a private carriage? It would be a deal more comfortable, not to say faster, and not that much dearer with the two of us travelling." Cassian was already shaking his head.
"No, I can't do that."
"Couldn't drive? Couldn't afford it? A carriage could be hired for £5 a month." If he couldn't afford to drive himself, that put the promised £50 in a different and significantly less certain light. Dazel wondered if he should ask for money up front, and decided against it as long as Cassian was paying his shot. Nevertheless, he felt a twinge of irritation at the unnecessary hardship that came out in his voice. "In that case, accustom yourself to the coach or walk. But we've covered 24 miles or so in 3 hours, and I wouldn't want to do that on foot even for the sake of peace and quiet."
"Yes, I know I encouraged him," Cassian said wearily. "And I should have ignored him. And a misplaced urge to be courteous merely exposes one to encroaching mushrooms. I know."
He looked small and rather defeated. Dazel repressed a sudden urge to pat him on the shoulder and assure him it would be all right.
"You should have ignored him, but it probably wouldn't have made a difference. That sort of man is like champagne."
Cassian's brows came together. In what possible way? "Constantly giving off gas, and if too much builds up without an outlet, it explodes." Cassian gave a shout of laughter, again with that startled note to it. His eyes were bright with amusement. Dazel hadn't really noticed his eyes before. Last night's inn had been too dark, and he hadn't paid particular attention this morning. In fairness, they weren't attention-grabbing eyes, being fundamentally grey. Except, if you looked, the grey had an unusual yellow tint to it, giving it the luminous colour of a rainy day turning to sun. They might be a very striking feature in a more striking face. Cassian had stopped laughing and was looking at him with puzzlement.
"Is there something on my face?"
"Damn it,
not at all," Dazel said.
"I am merely faint with hunger. I suggest we obtain luncheon here, if it is not too late to call it that, and start asking questions." Food was indeed restorative. Even more so was an intelligent hostler, who had seen the man in the mulberry, very overripe raspberry, coat, and informed them he'd taken the stage in the direction of Stratford-upon-Avon.
We're on the track.
We're on his track, and it's entirely thanks to you. Daisel didn't deny it. He sat back and enjoyed his ale, a bite of luncheon, being able to move and breathe before they got back on the stage, and mostly the pleasant and unfamiliar sensation of being the object of gratitude. He could definitely get used to this. When the stage arrived, it was at a slapping pace and pulled up very stylishly. It seemed the driver was encouraged by the applause of his companion on the box, a young sprig of fashion with exceedingly high collar points and many capes to his coat. They both got down, followed by the glares of at least 10 outside passengers who looked like their ride had been bumpy, and the young man pressed the driver to a mug of heavy wet as the horses were changed. Daisel cast them both a jaundiced look, and prepared for a journey that would probably be both faster and less comfortable than usual. Cassian looked a little uncertain.
I say, he murmured to Daisel, that fellow, the driver, is he quite sober?
I highly doubt it.
But if you're waiting for a driver who's quite sober, we'll be here a while, Daisel observed,
which was a gross slur against at least a fifth of the drivers he'd encountered. Not to mention that young oaf will probably want to tool the coach. Fashionable young men very frequently asked to take the reins of the stage. It was against the regulations, but they would beg, bribe, or bully the drivers until they had their way. Daisel might have done it himself in his reckless, feckless days, if the idea had ever occurred to him. He couldn't see the point now, and it meant an uncomfortable journey for everyone else. But there was no point objecting, since the driver was already the worse for wear.
Come on, get in. We don't both want to be stuck in the middle.
It was another six-seater. Daisel heard Cassian's little despairing noise, but he didn't complain out loud. Daisel took the middle seat next to him once more, vaguely feeling that the £50 made it his duty. That meant he had Cassian's slim frame squashed into one side, and on the other a woman who was buxom to the point of overflowing. Daisel appreciated a trim man and indeed a generous bosom, but he preferred it when people actually wanted to be pressed up against him. The lady was very reasonable about it, merely remarking how dreadfully cramped these coaches were, and concentrating on her baby, which stared at him with huge eyes.
A very handsome child, he remarked, to be friendly,
and won a beam of pleasure. He just hoped it wouldn't cry throughout the journey. The coach rattled off at great speed, lurching and bounding.
Someone's in a hurry, Daisel said.
At least they keep to time, one of the opposite passengers remarked.
The baby mewed. The buxom woman jiggled it soothingly.
Nasty, rattling things, aren't they, my puppet?
Very tolerant young person you have there, Daisel observed.
Oh, she's a good girl, aren't you? Say hello to the gentleman.
Hello, sir,
the woman added in a high-pitched voice, presumably on her child's behalf, and flapped its pudgy wrist. A little starfish hand reached out towards Daisel. He extended a finger out of curiosity and found it caught in a hot, sticky fist. Enormously round blue eyes stared at him with a look of uncomprehending examination, as though the baby was trying to establish what manner of man he was. Daisel wished it luck and attempted to extricate his finger, only to realize that babies had rather stronger grips than he'd expected. He tugged discreetly. The baby held on like grim death with chubby cheeks. A choke at his shoulder indicated that Cassian found his predicament amusing. His smile faded soon enough as the coach continued on its reckless way. If anything, it was speeding up, and Daisel felt the drag as they took a corner too fast. Cassian gripped his knees with white knuckles.
My God, he muttered.
There was noise from above now, a few cries of encouragement, more of protest. The mother clutched the baby to her with a little scream as the coach hit a rock or some such and a wheel left the ground.
Lord!
The baby wailed, but didn't release Daisel's finger. The coach bounded on.
This is too fast, Cassian said. Can we make him stop?
How?
Cassian's hands flexed, making fists as though he held reins. It's too fast if we take a corner at this speed with the coach top-heavy from all the people up there.
Bless you, young fellow, this is nothing, a man opposite said. I've seen 18 crammed atop a coach before now and never.
They hit a bump in the road that jolted Dazel right off the seat despite the close-packed interior. Someone swore in a mumble that suggested a bitten tongue. The coach lurched sideways and down on one side.
The axle's going, Cassian said sharply. The axle, hey, fellow!
He shoved his head out of the window, yelling for the driver. Stop! Stop!
Dazel hauled him back in by main force.
Stick your head out when we roll in the window, we'll chop it off quicker than a Frenchman, he snapped. Grab the strap, everyone grab a strap. When that wheel comes off, we're going over.
My baby,
the woman said on a terrified breath. Dazel looked at her, at arms that kneaded and scrubbed longer than he ever could, but shoulders that weren't used to taking weight, and at the tiny hand that held onto his finger as though he was someone to be trusted.
Give it to me, I'll hold her safe. Use the straps and brace with your feet when we go.
There's no need to fuss,
said one of the men opposite, but his voice suggested he knew that was wishful thinking.
No, he's right. Hold on, Cassian said.
The mother gave a sob of fear.
Please, Dazel said. Look to yourself and I'll hold her.
She held the child out. Dazel pulled the heavy little bundle into his arms, grappled her to him, wrapped the strap round his other wrist, and readied himself for the moment he knew was coming. And it came. With a crunch he felt more than heard. The axle gave. The wheel was off. The speeding coach lurched and rocked from side to side, so for a terrifying moment it might have gone either way. Dazel poured every ounce of concentration into locking the baby-holding arm immovably against his chest. Why in God's name was he doing this? He'd probably break his neck. And then the coach tipped and fell sideways. It was one of those moments that seemed incredibly slow. Dazel, who'd been braced and waiting for it, pushed himself up and off the seat with both feet, feeling the strap dig round his wrist, timing the motion to the inevitable crash as the coach hit and skidded along the surface of the road on its side. And the screams rose. Chapter 4. The toppled coach dragged along for a few terrifying seconds that felt like forever. They'd gone down on the left side, so Dazel thumped on top of the buxom woman and Cassian landed on top of them both, with extra feet and legs flailing from the other passengers. It was a maelstrom, a dizzying chaos of movement and bodies and pain and screaming. They rocked to a stop in what might have been a deathly silence except for a loud, enraged noise close to his ear. The baby. He'd still got the baby, and it was howling with infant fury. He felt a moment of bone-melting relief that it wasn't forever silent, and then started wishing it would stop. He was squashed in a heap of bodies with bones, heels, and elbows sticking into everything of him that was soft and vulnerable.
Cassian, he managed, shouting over the squalling. Cassian!
Ugh.
He wasn't the only one groaning. There was a low sobbing, and a male voice cursing in a low tone.
Is everyone all right, Cassian? Are you hurt?
No, I don't think anything's broken.
Then get the devil off me. Come on, move. Get out.
Where?
Cassian demanded with a note of panic. How?
Out of the window you fall above you. Move your ass. I've got a baby down here.
My baby,
wailed the woman from under Dazel.
Carney, oh God. God help us.
She's all right,
Dazel said, as if the baby's outraged shrieks didn't tell their own story.
Cassian, shift yourself before this deafens me.
He shoved to make the point. Cassian pulled himself together and clambered awkwardly out of the coach window. This involved him treading fairly heavily on Dazel, who expressed his feelings with as much moderation as he could.
Take the blasted baby, he shouted once the man was out. Come on, get her.
Cassian reached reluctantly down. Dazel jammed the struggling, crying, distressingly damp bundle into his hands, and then hoisted himself out of the window, attempting to use the coach itself rather than his fellow passengers for leverage. He found his feet despite shaky legs and stood on the top or side of the coach to survey the scene for a moment. Cassian was kneeling awkwardly by him, holding the baby with dismay. His nose was bleeding. On the road, people were scattered around in little weeping knots, or sprawled and unmoving. At least one had blood spreading around his head in a puddle. Dazel looked away, down at the horses, and swore like a trooper. "What is it?" Cassian demanded.
"Nobody's cut the traces."
Dazel clapped his hand to his pocket and was relieved to find his clasp knife. He skidded down the sidewise roof of the coach with reckless speed and ran to the horses' heads. Two had already struggled to their feet, and if the panicked creatures started to run again, dragging the overturned coach behind them, Christ knew what would happen to the four people still in there.
"Someone help me,"
he called to the world in general, and ran to start sawing at the leather straps. A third horse rose as he started cutting. The fourth was still down but kicking. He couldn't see the driver. The young sprig in the caped coat was watching with a fatuous grin.
"Help me,"
Dazel said again to nobody. There was a thump and a scrabble behind him, and Cassian was there, babyless.
"Cut the traces," Dazel shouted, "quick."
"No knife," Cassian said with a calm serenity that begged for punching and moved to the lead horse's head. He was disheveled, and his face was bloodstained, but his stance radiated peace. "There, boy. There."
"Get away before it kicks you,"
Dazel snarled. "He won't. Here now." He had an uncommonly sweet tone to his voice as he soothed the frantic horse. "Come, Beauty, be a good boy for me. Such a good boy, aren't you? Such a lovely, willing, very good boy." His tone was honey and velvet, and somehow Dazel's knife had slowed in its work at the murmured endearments. He gave himself a mental kick and severed another trace, but he could see and feel the horses calming under Cassian's influence. He cut the remaining traces anyway, in case, and clambered out of the way. Cassian gave the horse a final pat and stepped back. They looked at one another, and Cassian said, "What now?" For all the world as if Dazel was the expert on disasters. "Where's the baby?" "Oh." Cassian looked round and hurried to the grass verge, where he picked up the howling infant, keeping it at arm's length. Oh, it smells really very bad now, and it's squashy." "I doubt she's the only one to have soiled herself," Dazel remarked. "Where's the mother? Has anyone got the rest of them out?" Cassian looked blank. Dazel cursed internally and clambered up onto the coach again. The next little while was an aching, relentless slog. Two of the male inside passengers had made it out on their own. One was nursing a broken nose. The other was unharmed and much bigger than Cassian, so he and Dazel set to getting the last two free. The woman was battered and looked sick as a dog, but she thanked Dazel vocally and went to reclaim her child from Cassian with tears. The final man was curled in the bottom of the coach, sobbing with pain. "We need to get you out," Dazel said. "They won't be able to get the coach upright with you in it. Where does it hurt? Can you sit up?"
"My arm. My arm."
Dazel offered a cautious, supportive hand. He only wanted to take the fellow's weight, but as the man shifted, his arm moved in a terrible way and he screamed,
"Jesus, don't touch me!"
"Christ," Dazel muttered. "Hey, someone up there, help us." He and the other man managed the job eventually. It took heaving and shoving, and the victim screamed a lot and then passed out, which was a mercy all round. His arm was bent in bad ways. The other man cut off his coat sleeve, muttering about swelling, and they all saw the bloody, jagged bone sticking out of the skin. That was it. Dazel sprinted for the ditch and cast up his accounts, on his hands and knees on the dusty verge, puking with tears in his eyes. "Charnage." It was Cassian crouching beside him. "Are you all right?"
"No,"
Dazel said comprehensively.
"Christ, did you see?"
"I didn't look."
He'll lose the arm if he even lives. He screamed, I heard him. And the blood. The smell of it, and the look of terror in a man's eyes as he felt his death approach, and his own utter failure to do any good. Christ. Useless. I'm useless. Shh. Cassian reached out. Dazel grabbed his hand, all need and instinct, clutching it hard. Dusty, sweaty, warm, alive. Cassian held on tight, giving him a moment of silence he badly needed, then asked again, Are you all right? No, yes, of course I am. You've done everything you could, more than anyone else did. Come on. Cassian spoke in the calm voice, the one he'd used on the horse. Come on now, Charnage, I've got you. Good man. Up you get now. Dazel held onto his hand for a second longer, for both the physical comfort and that soothing voice. Then let go and hauled himself to his feet. Cassian put a hand on his arm. He didn't say anything stupid about it being all right or a nasty shock. He just stood by Dazel and touched him so he wasn't alone. He got about a minute of that peace, and then people started shouting. The outside passengers who'd been thrown off had now gathered themselves, those capable of it. Several were demanding what was to be done. It seemed the driver was unconscious. The man on the ground in a pool of blood wouldn't be getting up soon either. They were all stranded on a coach road to Stratford, and the woman with the baby had assured them all that the very kind, capable gentleman, bafflingly she meant Dazel, would know what to do. I want to know how we get to Stratford, a thin man said. I have urgent business.
I want compensation,
someone else added.
That driver handing over the reins like that.
Do I look like the coach company? Dazel retorted. I have no idea what we do except wait for another stage and get help. Or walk to find a house where they can send a cart, I suppose.
We need a doctor, someone said. There's three men in a bad way.
Someone has already gone back to the last house for help, said the thin man angrily. We could have driven on if you hadn't cut the traces.
Dazel stared at him. Cassian stepped in, quite literally, moving in front of him. You must not realize, sir, the horses were like to bolt with people still inside the coach. One with a dreadfully broken arm and one a lady. It was a necessary action in a difficult situation. I'm sure you understand. He sounded like someone who spent a lot of time pouring oil on troubled waters. The thin man didn't appear mollified.
So you say, but the urgency of my business...
Oh, he was in that coach, the mother announced, looking daggers at him. I would have been dragged along and killed if it wasn't for this gentleman who saved my baby, and if you think your nasty business should come before my little girl's very life, you miserable old stockfish! Cassian and Dazel eased back out of the way in silent synchrony to let her pulverize the fellow unimpeded. And everything might have simmered down if the fashionable young man hadn't spoken up, in a voice that sounded decidedly slurred.
Fair enough, hubby, let's get the tits back on the road, what? Coach back on its wheels, it'll take 2 minutes, and off we go.
The traces have been cut, the axle broke, and we lost a wheel, Cassian said. It will not be a swift repair.
Oh, hush, Mother Shipton,
the young man said with a dismissive flap of the hand.
We're strong fellows enough. We'll be back on our way in no time. Yikes.
Cassian stiffened. There are three seriously injured men here. What do you propose to do, leave them on the side of the road? The young man shrugged. Dazel held up a finger.
Sir, you were on the box when we set off. Am I correct in thinking you took the reins?
That's right, the young man beamed. What a ride, eh?
And you didn't feel the axle go, or think of slowing down?
You do realize you overturned us and people are seriously hurt. Cassian did not sound soothing anymore. His voice rose.
People might die because you crashed us.
Oh, rubbish. Everyone spills now and again, what? Accidents happen. Part of the fun. Lot of fuss.
Dazel considered that. He nodded slowly. Then he punched the young man with everything he had and was delighted to feel his nose break. The youth staggered back, clutching his face.
He seemed more shocked than hurt, which Dazel regretted.
You what? How dare you?
He said thickly.
You know who I am. I'm Tom Acaster. My father is Sir Benjamin Acaster.
You're a slobbering ape and your father is an imbecile for not drowning you at birth,
Dazel snarled. His throat still stung with the taste of vomit.
You stupid little turd, you've probably killed that man.
You wait till my father finds you. I'll have your name and direction, sir.
The youth's voice was nasal, choked with blood.
My name is Dazel Charnage. Charnage, like carnage with an H, got that?
And as for your father... He grabbed the youth's shoulder, threw him down to the ground with the aid of a foot between his ankles, and assisted him into the ditch by means of a few forceful kicks to the posterior. The howls and the muddy splash relieved his feelings a little. He turned away, brushing his hands, and realized everyone was staring at him.
I'm not saying you were wrong to do it, the baby's mother remarked thoughtfully. Not wrong, but Sir Benjamin lives just at Upton Snodsbury, not half a mile up the road, and he's powerful careful of his lad, and he's the magistrate hereabouts.
That young fool overturned us, Cassian said. Surely nobody will defend that. Everyone turned to look at him. Dazel contemplated the fact that they were an indeterminate way into the countryside, with a rich man's wrath a short distance off, and any replacement coach some hours away. Cassian, I think we'll walk. At least Cassian didn't have a trunk. They trudged along the road together, each with his travelling bag, under the April sun. Cassian had wiped most of the blood off his face, and seemed to be breathing without issue.
Your nose isn't broken? Dazel asked.
No, I'm prone to nosebleeds.
Good, not the nosebleeds, that it's not broken.
They crunched along some more. Dazel had led them off the main road at the first fork, and sincerely hoped they were going somewhere useful. He'd mostly been propelled by the urge not to have an outraged magistrate catch up with him. Cassian was wearing Wellington boots, which seemed not to be uncomfortable, but he looked much as a man might after being overturned in a chaise and forced to walk along a warm road without a drink, because his idiot companion had punched a powerful man's heir in the face. Sorry, Dazel said abruptly.
For what?
Hitting that fool.
Why?
Because now we're probably in a deal of trouble.
Nonsense, Cassian said.
I'm sure he'll be taken up by the authorities and held to account.
Weren't you listening? His father is the authorities.
There's plenty of magistrates. I don't see anything to worry about, and in any case, you did quite right, since he didn't seem to feel the slightest remorse.
Accidents happen, indeed.
Outrageous.
I'm not at all surprised you lost your temper.
It was a stupid thing to do. If we get in trouble...
I'm not worried about that,
Cassian said, with the serenity of the extremely naive. He would change his tune fast enough when he was faced with a rampaging baronet throwing around his wealth and authority.
And I had meant to say, too, thank you for what you did back there.
I did nothing.
You did everything. You saved that child.
Dazel felt himself flush, as if his face wasn't warm enough.
I dare say the mother could have held her if need be.
At the bottom of that heap?
No, it was a good thing to do and a kind one, Cassian said.
But really, I meant thank you for instructing me. I realize I was no great help to you, and I'm sorry for it.
You're astonishing with those horses. When I realized I needed to be, which is to say when you pointed out the problem, I couldn't seem to think.
He sounded as though it was eating at him.
I simply panicked, which is contemptible. I don't know why, I've had spills before.
Being a passenger in a stage is quite different from driving your own team.
You can't see what's going to happen, you aren't in charge.
Cassian nodded, confirming that indeed he did drive his own horses.
Why wasn't he now?
Whereas that was my third tumble in a stagecoach, so I'm used to it.
Not that sort of tumble, he added as Cassian choked.
I should hope not, there would hardly be space.
And all the passengers looking on puts a man off his stroke.
Cassian snorted. Someone would tell you they'd been on a stage where four passengers. Dazel's bruised shoulders hurt with the shaking as he laughed. It felt good, though, lifting the cloud. What I was trying to say was, I've had that unlovely experience twice before. The first time I was no use to man or beast. I sat there stunned and I wasn't even injured. I couldn't seem to take in what had happened. Just useless.
Yes, Cassian said in a low voice. That's how I felt.
But you weren't. You did what you were told, Daisel said. That's better than the people who stand around and cry. And even they're better than the ones who get in the way. You did as well as anyone could expect. And next time you can deal with the horses and the swine who thinks he's a whip and the one who wants to drive the coach over the bodies to get to his important engagement.
I'll look forward to it, Cassian said.
You think people do get used to these things? To dealing with emergencies? If you have enough of them?
Yes, but what if you don't?
Or haven't? I mean, if one is used to being held up by a scaffolding of other people and has never encountered emergencies, might one not discover one is helpless without that support?
Daisel wasn't entirely sure what he was actually being asked, but it sounded painful.
Everyone relies on other people, and eventually most people let you down one way or another, so I dare say it's a good thing to practice dealing with difficulties on your own. But I don't see there's any great moral virtue in it.
Do you not think independence is a virtue?
Overrated, Daisel said. One should be able to do things for oneself, but the world would surely be a better place if we did more for one another.
Yes, Cassian said. Yes, that is true. And we can't all expect to do everything.
Certainly not right, and definitely not the first time we try.
No. Although even so, nobody wants to be helpless.
No.
Daisel knew exactly how it felt to be helpless.
No, that is an unpleasant sensation.
One feels so pointless, Cassian said,
filling a place rather than being useful. That was not how Daisel would have described the sensation of having his entire life torn from his control, ripped up and thrown away. But doubtless they had different experiences of helplessness.
Well, you weren't that. You did perfectly well and better than many would have, and if those horses had bolted, things would have been a deal worse. You've nothing to rebuke yourself for.
Then we can both flatter ourselves we made the best of a bad situation. If we weren't trudging along on an apparently endless road with no place of refreshment in sight, and an enraged magistrate likely on our tail, I might agree with you.
Cassian gave his startled laugh.
Well, there is that, but I'm sure we'll find somewhere. I suppose everyone from the coach is all right.
No idea, Daisel said.
I imagine someone would have come along by now and we'd reached the limits of what I was able to offer in the way of help.
That met with a silence. He glanced over and saw Cassian looking rather struck.
No?
I was just thinking that I could have done more.
Oh, curse it, I know I should.
I don't see how, unless you're a bone setter.
He remembered again the splintered end of bone, the torn skin and obscenely bared flesh, and shuddered the memory off.
Cassian glanced over. Are you all right?
Daisel didn't want to talk about it.
Is that a farmhouse there?
It was a farmhouse, and a friendly one. The mistress of the house tutted and sympathized at their shocking escape from danger, as narrated by Daisel with a bit of flair, agreed that coaches were nasty rattling things that went too fast, brought them tankards of excellent home-brewed, and let them sluice off the blood and dirt and dust in the yard with a bucket, while she went to consult someone called Jed Browning as to how they could best carry on their journey.
Daisel thought of nothing but being briefly cool and clean as he stripped to the waist and dumped water over his head. He scrubbed his face, dunked his head in the bucket and shook it like a dog to get the contamination of the day out of his curls, poured handfuls of water over his torso, and opened his eyes to see Cassian watching. His mouth was slightly slack, his sun and rain eyes fascinated, and they weren't locked on Daisel's face either.
Well,
Daisel had no objection to being looked at, especially not in the hungry way Cassian was looking. He did have a strong objection born of experience to people looking and being caught looking and regretting it,
and it's somehow becoming his fault that they'd given themselves away. So he shut his eyes again before Cassian could realize they were open, made perhaps a slightly excessive performance of rubbing and stretching, and scrubbed at his face before saying, "Do you want the bucket?" "Please." Cassian sounded a little stifled, but he took it and sluiced himself down in turn, and Daisel took the chance to watch while he could. Turnabout was fair play. Cassian definitely stripped to advantage. The candlelight hadn't lied. Slim but not willowy, not tall, not too much sinew and muscle. He was an elegant package, Daisel thought. A picture that repaid attention, with the water running rivulets down his skin in droplets that begged to be caught with a finger. A finger that Daisel might pop into his mouth, or even between Cassian's parted, expressive lips. Bad Daisel. Bad. 50 pounds, he reminded himself, and reached for the rough cloth to dry off. Jed Browning, it transpired, had a cart, and was going past a hamlet whose name Daisel instantly forgot, where there was an inn that would give them a meal and a bed. It was now close on 5 o'clock, still warm and light, but night had a way of springing itself on you when you were on foot in the countryside. They thanked their benefactress. Cassian rewarded her for her kindness, lavishly, Daisel guessed by her expression, and they climbed into the back of Jed Browning's cart, resting on hay bales. That was the sort of thing that looked charmingly pastoral in paintings, but was surprisingly prickly in practice. It also tended to insects. But Cassian didn't object, lying back to look at the sky, and if he was happy, Daisel wouldn't be complaining. The hay cushioned the jolting as the cart rumbled over the rough, stony path, and it was a while since Daisel had lain back companionably with someone he liked and enjoyed the moment. "You were dashed good with the horses," he remarked. "Do you have your own?" "A pair I trained myself, of whom I'm very proud. Horses are wonderful creatures. So much life and feeling, and they hardly ever judge one." "Hardly ever?" "Oh, I've been judged by horses," Cassian said with a laugh, "when I've been egregiously foolish or careless. But mostly they're very accepting." "But you're not driving yourself now?"
"No."
It sounded a little awkward.
"I had reasons to go by the public coach."
"I'm sure," Daisel said.
"Well, it's such a safe and comfortable way to travel. Highly convenient, too, never taking one out of one's way. And so reasonably priced," Daisel finished.
He could see Cassian's grin, and his own lips were curving.
"I expect you'll sell your own pair and become an aficionado."
"I won't do that," Cassian said. And though he was smiling still, Daisel felt he meant it. They were peacefully silent a little longer. Then Cassian said,
"Charnage?"
"Daisel, sorry?"
"If you don't object, most people call me by my first name, that's all. Daisel, or Daze for short. Unless you'd rather not, of course."
He cringed internally as he spoke, kicking himself for the unguarded offer. Of course Cassian wouldn't want to be on first-name terms with him. This was a temporary association, not a friendship, and Daisel would do well to remember that.
"It doesn't matter, Charnage does very well."
"No," Cassian said, "no, I would like to."
"Thank you,
Daisel." The name sounded magical in his soft voice.
"That's an awfully unusual name. I should think it's unique. Where is it from?"
Daisel had of necessity told this story a great deal. The familiarity helped him recover himself from the surge of embarrassment and then of pleasure, and the sound of his name in Cassian's voice.
"Are you familiar with the name Diel?"
He pronounced it in the Scots way and saw Cassian frown.
"Diel, you mean the letters D-L?"
"Pronounced D-L, spelt D-A-L-Z-I-E-L. It's a Scottish surname. My mother's uncle, Ralph Diel, took great pride in his roots, and when I was born, my parents hoped to curry favour. He was rich. I was to be D.L. Charnage in his honour.
and he was to hand over the Reddys in his will, you see. Except my father's ability to spell was commensurate with his other talents. So he had me christened Daisel, with the I and L in the wrong places, and wrote as much to Uncle Ralph, who pointed out the mistake. Some people would have corrected themselves and smoothed matters over, but my father did not like to have his mistakes pointed out. He insisted my name was indeed Daisel, pronounced as spelled. Uncle Ralph took the hump, and there went my chance at a rich godfather and an inheritance. But at least I have an interesting name out of it.
Good heavens, Cassian said. That's, remarkable.
Very typical of my father. And myself, I suppose.
Cassian twisted round to look at him, with a little frown.
Well, it suits you, I think. Daisel, then.
Oh. I would return the compliment, but...
He didn't want Daisel Charnish to call him by his first name.
Naturally not.
Daisel kept his features pleasant despite the familiar, hateful way his stomach clenched at the rejection, and waved an airy hand.
As you prefer. I didn't mean I wouldn't want, The thing is, I loathe my name.
Daisel blinked.
You... My name, my first name, I hate it. It doesn't suit me at all, and I think it's hideous, actually.
Ah, right.
He controlled himself for about 3 seconds, then gave up.
No, sorry, I have to ask.
Vernon.
Daisel sat up a little, the better to contemplate him. Vernon.
Vernon.
Vernon? Good God, no. What were your parents thinking?
It's as though they barely knew me at the time, Cassian agreed with a lurking grin.
I suppose it wouldn't be so bad if I were a 6-foot Corinthian with huge shoulders. It sounds more to me like a dastard who attempts to seduce the heroine, but is undone by seducing the housemaid.
Not me either way.
Whereas Cassian is, oh, delightful. It has a certain, what shall I say, a fairy tale quality.
You're thinking of Ossian, the Scottish bard.
I probably am, but it still suits you.
Charming the birds out of the trees, or rather the horses out of their panic, by the sound of your voice.
Of course you're a bard.
Cassian actually blushed at that, a delightful dusky pink, accompanied by a smile of startled pleasure. I can't play the harp, he protested, or the bagpipes.
Thank God for small mercies.
Daisel would have liked to expound more on Cassian's voice, see how much darker he might blush. He restrained himself.
So your friends call you Cassian?
It's what I prefer to be called. I'd be very glad if you would.
Then that's what I'll call you.
Is it ever abbreviated or always used in full?
Well, I'd be happy with Cass.
He sounded quite shy. It was absurdly endearing.
Cass. Very well.
And at least your name didn't open you up to the wrath of uncles, unless, of course, you have a rampaging Uncle Vernon who's offended you don't use it.
Oh, it is an uncle name, isn't it? A terribly strict one who has control of the heroine's money and intends to marry her to his wayward son.
I see you are a connoisseur of elevating literature, Daisel said.
Have you read the latest Mrs. Swan?
Cassian had not, but he had a deal to say about the Waverley author, whose work Daisel also enjoyed. And they talked and argued and laughed as the cart jogged along in the evening sunshine.
Chapter 5 Daisel. The Duke didn't intend to read too much into the move to first names. He'd learned his lesson with attractive men. He would do well to solve the problem his wayward desires had already caused him before following them into more trouble. And Daisel Charnage was trouble. Very pleasant trouble. Trouble with shining hair, but trouble nonetheless. His name alone said that, and his erratic history. And now the Duke had seen it for himself. Not that he blamed Daisel for punching that drunken fool. The Duke would have rather liked to do the same. If only he had been either built or bred to punch people in the face. It was more that Daisel clearly had reason to think it was a bad idea. The Duke didn't share his alarm at possible retribution from a local magistrate, but since Dazel did, he should have thought twice. The Duke tried hard to think twice, since one of his uncle's oft-repeated lessons was that a man in a position such as his own should never act on impulse. A duke must assess his behavior, consider his course, ponder its rightness, because the consequences of his errors would be large. His uncle wasn't wrong. The Duke hadn't thought through all the possibilities and implications when he agreed.